content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media, each week, and we'll be reading from this Friday's edition, dated February the 11th, 2011. And we'll start reading from the main stories of The Week magazine. The first article here is entitled, Egypt's Days of Wrath. What happened? A nascent revolution rolled across Egypt this week like a flood tide as hundreds of thousands of protesters dominated Cairo's main square. Domestic and international support for President Hosni Mubarak eroded, and other autocrats in the region nervously offered concessions to their own angry populations. The White House scrambled to keep up with Egypt's popular wave, issuing early words of support for Mubarak, but then calibrating its stance as the revolt intensified. Mubarak, who is now 82, tried to appease the throngs, calling for his resignation by pledging not to run for re-election in the fall, while President Obama pointedly stated that a democratic transition must begin now. Mubarak insisted he would not leave the country. "This is my homeland," Mubarak said in a broadcast. "I will die on its soil." The only intensified the revolt, and by midweek, protesters were repelling an attack by several thousand seemingly well-organized Mubarak supporters, some on horses and camels, which left hundreds injured. The rebellion began when hundreds of thousands of Egyptians rallied in Cairo's Tahrir Square, several times calling for Mubarak's immediate ouster and free and fair elections. With the army pledging not to fire on them, some Egyptians slept in the square, occupying the burned-out husks of cars or claiming space in flower beds. "Egypt is mine," read one graffito. The protests were populated by secular youths and laborers unhappy with food prices and low wages, as well as by the followers of the Fundamentalist Brotherhood, Muslim Brotherhood, that is. Mohammed El-Baradei, former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, returned to Egypt after years in Europe and offered to lead a unity government after Mubarak's departure. He called on the U.S. to stop the life support to the dictator and root with the people. The Egyptians' defiance of Mubarak, who'd presided over a sham election last year, sent tremors across the Middle East. In Jordan, King Abdullah II sacked his cabinet this week in an effort to appease critics, while in Yemen, President Ali Abdullah Saleh, whose government was rocked by demonstrations just last week, promised to end his three-decade reign when his term expires in 2013. "Egypt has been the political, cultural, and social lighthouse for the Arab people," said Hadi Jallo, a political analyst in Baghdad. Now here's what the editorial said. "For too long, it's been American policy to ignore the democratic aspirations of Arab populations," said the Wall Street Journal. "Most presidents, including Obama, have preferred the stability of friendly regimes. One president, George W. Bush, had a different vision, launching a freedom agenda for the Middle East. It was roundly mocked by the liberal realists who dominate the U.S. foreign policy establishment. Now we see where their cynical and sour realism has gotten us. How much better positioned would we be in Egypt today if we were able to take some credit for the calls for freedom and democratic change?" Everyone is nervous about the potential for radical Islamic forces to influence what comes next, said the Financial Times, but it would be folly for the U.S. and its European allies to put themselves on the wrong side of history by denying Arab aspirations to human rights and economic advancement. "That's dangerous pablum," said Investors Business Daily. "The Muslim Brotherhood, a radical Islamist group, is in talks with El-Baradei to form a new coalition government. If that happens, Egypt, a largely secular society and longtime ally of the U.S., will become our enemy and Israel's too." Now here's what the columnist had to say. It's unclear what kind of future Egyptians want, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner, but a Pew poll conducted last year isn't very encouraging. Researchers found that 84% of Egyptians favor the death penalty for people who leave the Muslim religion. They also favor Islamic fundamentalists over groups that want to modernize the country. For people embarking on a democratic experiment, Egyptians hold some views that Westerners find utterly inconsistent with democracy. Don't discount the courage and idealism alive in Tahrir Square, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Everywhere I go, Egyptians insist to me that Americans shouldn't perceive their movement as a threat. I may be drinking the Kool-Aid here, but we owe it to our own history and values to stand with the peaceful throngs pleading for democracy. It would be nice if President Obama would show he recognizes that, said Jonathan Chait in the New Republic Online. Even after Mubarak's thugs attacked protesters this week, the White House refused to condemn Mubarak and demand his resignation. Whose side is Obama on? The president has good reason to be cautious, said Leslie Gelb in the DailyBeast.com. The devil we know is President Mubarak. In the history of Mideast bad guys, he's far from the worst. The inevitable beneficiary of regime change in Cairo will be the Muslim Brotherhood, which would be calamitous for U.S. security. The Brotherhood, more than eight decades old, is the original Islamic fundamentalist group. It supports Hamas and other terrorist groups, makes friendly noises to Iranian dictators and torturers, and opposes peace with Israel. We can't afford self-delusion about what will follow Mubarak. Yet what choice do we have, says Max Boot in the Wall Street Journal. A post-Mubarak Egypt will probably distance itself from the West and forge a stronger alliance with the rest of the Islamic world. But the U.S. will retain leverage over Cairo with its billions in aid. Face it, Mubarak's day is done. The U.S. and its allies can only try to make the transition as fast and painless as possible. Now, turning back to news from the United States here, the next item is entitled, Healthcare Law Takes a Big Hit. A federal judge in Florida this week ruled that President Obama's healthcare overhaul is void because it unconstitutionally forces Americans to buy health insurance. In a 78-page ruling, U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson, a Reagan appointee, said that Congress had overstepped its powers by mandating fines under the Affordable Care Act for anyone who isn't insured. The judge backed the challenge, brought by 26 states, with the pointed analogy that a nation founded in opposition to paying tax on tea shouldn't let government force people to buy tea in the first place. Two judges appointed by Democrats previously upheld the law. Vinson, the second Republican appointee to rule against it, was the first to throw out the entire act, arguing that the reform plan was based on the mandate for all Americans to have insurance. Some states said they would now stop preparing to implement the health care law altogether, but the White House insisted it remains in effect, pending an appeal. The Supreme Court will ultimately decide the law's fate, most likely in 2012. Judge Vinson's exhaustive and erudite opinion thwarts a massive overreach of federal power, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Commerce Clause, which the Obama administration cites to justify its intrusion into individuals' health care decisions, allows Congress to regulate interstate trade, not force people to buy insurance. Now no one doubts that Obamacare is unconstitutional, said the Washington Times, except Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and President Obama. Those three have no one to blame but themselves, said David Weigel in Slate.com. The Democrats panicked when Scott Brown's surprise victory in Massachusetts deprived them of a filibuster-proof majority, so they rammed the bill through Congress without adding the standard severability clause, which states that a law remains in effect if part of it is struck down. That's why health reform now lies tattered on Judge Vinson's carpet. Vinson's overtly partisan ruling is the second coming of Bush versus Gore, said Ben Adler in Newsweek. His Tea Party colored language makes it clear he's motivated by politics, not the law, and undermines his ruling. More important, it won't sit well with Justice Anthony Kennedy. The swing vote on the Supreme Court, a man particularly fond of trying to find common ground. And now the controversy of the week from The Week magazine. Obama, is he truly now a centrist? America appears to have a new president, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal. After seeing his approval ratings plummet and the Democratic Party take a serious beating in the midterm elections, President Obama has charted a new course for the next 2 years, tacking to the center. The president's State of the Union address last week was clearly designed to woo independent voters and disillusioned admirers who really did believe he'd be a postpartisan leader. Sketching out a grand political bargain to solve our myriad problems, Obama proposed a 5-year spending freeze on discretionary federal programs, a consolidation of federal departments to eliminate waste, and a restructuring of the corporate tax rate to stimulate hiring. He also advocated a partnership between government and private business, forged with new federal investment in biomedical research, technology, and other growth industries. Obama's surprising shift to the center need not merely be symbolic, said former Clinton pollster Mark Penn in the Washington Post. Look at what Bill Clinton achieved after his course correction in 1994. Cuts in federal spending, welfare reform, new trade agreements, a booming economy, and a budget surplus. A centrist agenda is not just a practical electoral strategy. It's the path to great things and a great presidency. Actually, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, the Obama I heard last week was the same overly earnest professor who has occupied the Oval Office for 2 years, talking down to the American people. He barely addressed the deficit, asking us to believe he's suddenly a fan of shrinking and streamlining government. As for the 15 million Americans who are unemployed, Obama offered them greater internet access, wind and solar, and high-speed rail, all sometime in the indefinite future. Instead of seizing the center, he went straight for the mush. Maybe he thinks that's what centrism is. This was a missed opportunity for Obama, said Matthew Continetti in the Weekly Standard. The day after he spoke, the Congressional Budget Office estimated the coming year's deficit at $1.5 trillion. Americans are in the mood to take fiscal issues seriously. Had Obama used this speech to reposition himself as a deficit hawk and to advocate the specific proposals of his own deficit commission, he would have won the support of many Republicans as well as independents. Instead, he punted. Now it's up to Republicans to take the ball and run. Actually, Obama did address the deficit, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. In addition to proposing a 5-year freeze on domestic spending, he warned, albeit vaguely, of the need for other painful measures, including cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. And he challenged Republicans to work with him on the budget crisis, saying, "We will move forward together or not at all, for the challenges we face are bigger than the party." Unfortunately, neither party is willing to take the drastic steps that are necessary, said William Galston in the New Republic. The GOP still clings to its perennial delusion that we can cut taxes and cut the deficit at the same time, and neither Republicans nor Democrats have the guts to overhaul Social Security or Medicare, fearing a backlash from older voters in 2012. As a result, the government will spend more than $1 trillion more than it takes in for the third consecutive year. With Washington still playing political games, a fiscal train wreck looms ahead. And now it's time for our special feature from The Week magazine entitled Good Week for and Bad Week for. Well, this week it was a good week for visible evolution. after a gorilla named Ambom was filmed walking upright on two legs for sustained periods in a British zoo. Ambom's handlers believed he learned to walk like a human in order to gain a height advantage over his rivals and to free his hands to carry more food. It was a good week for Frank Buckles, the last surviving World War I veteran, who turned 110 this week. About 4.7 million American doughboys served in that war, and Buckles has outlived every one of them. And it was a good week for house shopping after census data showed that 18.4 million homes in the U.S., 11% of all homes, are vacant because of foreclosures, bankruptcies, and a decline in demand. And it was a bad week for propaganda after China Central Television aired video that it said showed a Chinese J-10 fighter plane blowing up another plane during a training exercise. The clip was actually filched from the movie Top Gun. It was a bad week for U.S. Representative Dennis Kucinich after he sued the company that runs the House cafeteria, saying a sandwich wrap he bit into contained an olive pit that broke six of his teeth and required multiple surgical and dental procedures. Kucinich quickly settled the lawsuit for an undisclosed sum. And it was a bad week for terrorism with the news that a suicide bomber planning an attack in Moscow was blown to bits when an unexpected text message to a cell phone attached to the bomb detonated it. The message from her phone service provider, was wishing her a Happy New Year. And that's good week for and bad week for Friday, February 11th, 2011. And now let's take a look at the People section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled The Enigmatic Reagan. Ron Reagan is an ambivalent son, said Manuel Roig Franzia in the Washington Post. If his older brother Michael Reagan is the torchbearer of their father's conservative politics, and sister Patty Davis, who once bared herself in Playboy, is the black sheep, then Ron has had a more complicated role. He and his father shared a fondness for each other that was colored by mutual incomprehension. An avowed liberal and atheist, Ron says his father worried that I'd find life to be this horrible abyss of despair. He hasn't, although his life hasn't been simple. A ballet dancer in his early days, he's been rumored to be gay for as long as he can remember. To me, it's like someone claiming I'm Chinese, Reagan says. It's not pejorative. It's just incorrect. He's been married to the same woman, Doria, for 30 years. Lately, he's caused an uproar for suggesting his father showed signs of Alzheimer's while in office. I wasn't worried that he was going to launch a nuclear attack because he thought he was turning the TV on, says Reagan, but the Alzheimer's might have exacerbated tendencies to trust his aides too much. I'm thinking of Iran-Contra. Though they seldom agreed, he believes his father meant well. Now, 52, he wishes he had his dad's certitude. I'm still asking myself what I want to be when I grow up. The next item, the actor who apes the apes. Peter Elliott is an expert at reversing evolution, said Nick Liptak in The New Yorker. For 25 years, Elliott has been Hollywood's go-to actor whenever a director needs a human being to portray an ape. He got his start in the mid-80s on the film Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan. Casting for Silverbeard, Tarzan's adopted ape father, producers went through more than 40 actors before becoming enamored of Elliott's screen test. To be sure he was right for the part, they sent him to the Institute for Primate Studies at the University of Oklahoma. The idea was to see if I could socially integrate into a group of chimps, Elliott recalls. In full costume, he fooled the real simians, and the roles came flooding in. He played the ape Simba in Gorillas in the Mist, the title role in the film Buddy, and consulted on Congo. There are, he says, tricks to his trade. You've got to try and lose the human leg length. You can do that by dropping the crotch. For the behavior, for the look of it, you need to learn all the sounds and the faces. You have to have a different breathing rhythm, a different backbone, a different weight. You treat it like a normal acting role. It's method chimping, he says. And the next item is Adams' inner toughness. Amy Adams is not as dainty as she might seem, said Sophie Heawood in the London Guardian. Adams, 36 years old, may project an air of sweet refinement, but growing up in Colorado, she punched out some people. I was a pretty scrappy, tough kid, she says. I got in all kinds of fights at school. Boys didn't mess with me. Part of her brawling nature comes from the fact that she was one of seven children. You have to fight for everything. But mainly it came from being raised by her divorced mother, a semi-professional bodybuilder. I think it was a way to reclaim her own body after giving birth so many times. Mom worked in the gym where she trained, so we hung out there and terrorized the place. We were always very physically fit and involved in sports. Knowing how to handle herself has come in handy at different points in her life, from the playground to fending off grabby patrons while waitressing at Hooters, one of her first jobs. She regrets ever telling anyone about that gig. It's all about my 3 weeks at Hooters, she sighs. All anybody wants to know about is Hooters. I owe it all to the boob bar. And I found an interesting article, oddly enough, in the obituary section to add to the People coverage from the Week magazine this week. This is entitled, The Free Spirit Who Rafted Across the Atlantic. The subject we're talking about is a fellow by the name of Papa Neutrino, who was born in 1933 and just died in 2011. In 1983, David Perelman felt reborn, recovering in Mexico from a life-threatening illness brought on by a dog bite. He decided to take a new name to celebrate his survival. He immediately thought of the neutrino, a barely detectable subatomic particle that moves at nearly the speed of light, and so he christened himself Papa Neutrino, a peripatetic street musician and ocean-going adventurer whom his biographer Alec Wilkinson called the happiest man in the world. Even before he changed his name, Neutrino lived a turbulent life, said the New York Times. His father, a Navy sailor, shipped out to sea before his son was born. His mother was a chronic gambler who never stayed anywhere long. By his reckoning, young David attended 40 to 50 different schools. For some reason I love this, he said years later. If I ever wanted a stable life as a child, I've repressed it. At age 15, he lied about his age and enlisted in the Army, said the Washington Post. Upon his discharge, he wandered the country along Route 66, briefly enrolled in a Texas seminary, and spent time with poet Allen Ginsberg in San Francisco. Little is known of his life in the following few years. He claimed to have worked as a sign painter, a pastor, and a reporter in Vietnam. But at some point, he settled in New York City and started the First Church of Fulfillment, which he described as the only church in the history of the world that didn't know the way. Four times married, Neutrino led his burgeoning family on journeys across the U.S. and through Mexico, said the Wall Street Journal. To raise money, the family learned to play jazz and rhythm and blues on pawn shop instruments, performing as the Flying Neutrinos. The band survives to this day, directed by Neutrino's daughter Ingrid Lucha Marshall and Todd Lodigan, a musician he raised as his son. One of the few places the family settled for any length of time was on a houseboat built of cast-off wood and harbor debris, docked in Manhattan. Another boat made of scrap was the vessel for Neutrino's most famous achievement, said the Cape Cod Times. Living in Provincetown, Massachusetts, in the 1990s, Neutrino got it in his head to lash together a raft from discarded timber, foam bricks, and plastic bottles, and sail it across the ocean. Bearing Neutrino, his wife, two friends, and three dogs, the lumpy but eventually triumphant craft made the crossing from Provincetown to Ireland in 60 days, surviving 20-foot waves and periodic food shortages. Neutrino suffered a heart attack while en route. Toward the end of his life, Neutrino auditioned for American Idol. In his homemade audition videotape, he said, "I've traveled the world with just the spare change in my pocket. I don't pay rent because I can't afford to. But I've had experiences that not even the wealthiest of us can imagine." And by the way, Papa Neutrino died with $4.44 in his bank account. What a biography. You're listening to The Week magazine for February 11th, 2011. Now let's turn to the special section called The Briefing. This week, the headline of The Briefing is The Dire State of the States. From California to New York, states are facing monstrous deficits. The forecast calls for pain. Are the states really broke? Yes, Illinois-owned comptroller admitted it's a deadbeat state. So cash-starved that it has hiked income tax rates by 66% and simply stopped paying the $6 billion it owes to schools, pharmacies, and a host of other creditors. California is fending off vendors with IOUs, and Arizona has sold off its state house and Senate buildings and stopped covering organ transplants for Medicaid patients. Partly as a result of steep cuts in state aid, Camden, New Jersey, a desperately poor city of 80,000 that's ranked by CQ Press as the second most dangerous city in the country, laid off 167 of its 373 police officers in January. The day the layoffs took effect, laundromat owner Carmelo Villegas pointed across the street to a boarded-up house he said was a drug den. "It's like giving a license," he said, "to these crooks to come in and try to take over." How did these governments get in this jam? They sailed into a fiscal perfect storm. Income and sales tax receipts plummeted during the Great Recession, and they aren't improving quickly. This year, the National Association of State Budget Officers expects receipts to fall to 6.5% below 2008 levels, and it could be 5 years before they regain that mark. Meanwhile, outlays for Medicaid and unemployment insurance continue to rise. So do pension obligations negotiated in fatter years between politicians and unions keen to keep each other happy. Some $246 billion in federal stimulus funds have helped make up some of the shortfall, but that money will run out at the end of June. "I don't like to play the scared rabbit," says investment banker Felix Rohatyn, who steered New York City through a severe budget crisis in the 1970s, "but I just don't see where the end of this is." Which states are hardest hit? Some of the nation's biggest: California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, and Texas are generally agreed to be in the deepest holes. Their budget deficits accounts for half the collective $140 billion in state shortfalls expected this year. But they're hardly alone. All but 10 states are projected to post deficits this year, and the measures they're taking to close them, including tax hikes, public employee layoffs, and cutbacks in aid to cities and towns, may only prolong their misery. "Governments are the biggest employers in the country," said Jerome Powell of the Bipartisan Policy Center, a Washington think tank. "To have spending cuts and tax increases is going to be a burden on economic growth for several years." Who will suffer the most? People who are the most dependent on state government, public employees, and the poor. No one can be shielded from this reality anymore. Not policemen, not firefighters, not teachers, Republican Governor Chris Christie told a disgruntled cop at a recent town hall meeting in New Jersey. "Don't be angry at the first guy who told you the truth." In California, Governor Jerry Brown has dismayed fellow Democrats by proposing $12.5 billion in spending cuts that will land hardest on state universities, welfare programs, and health care for the poor. But Republicans are no happier with Brown's proposal to extend hikes in income, sales, and car registration taxes due to expire this year. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, another Democrat, has pledged not to raise taxes but is proposing steep cuts in Medicaid benefits to the poor, a wage freeze for state workers, and the elimination of some state agencies. Many states are proposing drastic cutbacks in state employee pension systems, which cumulatively have $1 trillion in unfunded obligations. Well, how does this get resolved? Not without major pain. A growing number of conservative politicians, notably former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, want to change current federal law to allow states to declare bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, he says, would let states free themselves from the lucrative pay and benefits packages secured by government employee unions. But critics of that idea point out that state bankruptcy wouldn't affect most of the contracts in debt, which are held by transit authorities and other subordinate state agencies. Bankruptcy, moreover, would turn struggling states into financial pariahs. The last state to default on its debt was Arkansas in 1933. It was unable to build a single road for the next 16 years, and many of its young people moved away. Instead of declaring bankruptcy, governors may demand that unions agree to givebacks in benefits and pensions or face massive layoffs. Either way, unprecedented cuts in services and personnel are inevitable. The debt crisis in states and cities is the largest threat to the U.S. economy, said financial analyst Meredith Whitney, who rose to prominence predicting that subprime mortgages would bring banks to their knees. It has tentacles as wide as anything I've seen. And a footnote to the briefing on the dire state of the states, dying beyond their means. The state's continuing financial crisis is taking a steep toll on schools, state houses, and police forces. But spare a thought for the dead. From Arizona to Virginia, budget cuts are forcing towns and counties to slash subsidies for burying the indigent. Local coroners have long paid much, if not all, of the cost of burying the poor. But in Wayne County, Michigan, which includes Detroit, the coroner's budget for indigent burials is so inadequate that the county is storing 185 bodies in a vault. Some have been there since 2008. Toledo, Ohio is one of many jurisdictions across the country considering a switch to cremation, which is cheaper than coffin burial, as the default method of interment, unless the deceased religion forbids it. The new focus on costs of even this final instance makes some city officials uneasy. If we believe there is a certain sacredness and sanctity of human life that extends after death, said Toledo City Councilor Steve Steele, then what we do when folks can't afford the increasing cost of a decent interment says a lot. Now let's take a look at the best columns in the U.S. for this past week. The first one is entitled WikiLeaks 15 Minutes of Fame. The WikiLeaks era is drawing to an end, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, not long after its founder, mercurial cyber militant Julian Assange, burst onto the world stage with overwrought promises to usher in a transformative new age of total transparency. WikiLeaks is in tatters. Assange himself faces jail time on rape charges. His lieutenants have been so alienated by his domineering ways that they're launching a competing organization called OpenLeaks. The New York Times, a conduit for WikiLeaks material, plans to cut out the middleman by opening its own secure digital channel for leaks of documents and other secrets. The aura Assange once created around his renegade organization is fading. He's only released about 3,000 of the 251,287 diplomatic cables he obtained from the State Department, and most of them consisted of diplomatic trivia, or gossipy confirmation of things we already know. The public's interest in those cables has already petered out. Government secrets were leaked to the public long before WikiLeaks came along, and that necessary corrective will continue long after the arrogant Assange and his website disappear. The next column is entitled The Cold Truth About Electric Cars by Charles Lane of the Washington Post. If you live anywhere affected by this week's frigid weather, said Charles Lane, you should be glad you're not driving an all-electric car. President Obama is constantly promoting electric cars as the solution to the country's energy and greenhouse gas problems, and in his State of the Union address set a goal of putting 1 million plug-in hybrids and all-electric vehicles on the road by 2015. But electric batteries have a chemical problem that the president is ignoring. They run down quickly in cold weather. A drop of 10 degrees, in fact, could sap 50% of a battery's output, dramatically reducing the already limited range of these vehicles. It's not hard to imagine the battery running down in the midst of a brutal snow and ice storm, stranding you and your fellow electric car drivers on a highway. Not incidentally, putting 1 million of these cars on the road would mean 99.6% of our vehicles would remain gas-powered, so the reduction in emissions or oil importation would be negligible. Call me a curmudgeon, but the electric car is not yet ready for prime time. And the third best column in the U.S., according to The Week magazine this week, is entitled, When the Real Church Stands Up. What would Jesus do? It's too bad Bishop Thomas Olmsted of Phoenix didn't ask himself that question, said Nicholas Kristof, before stripping the St. Joseph's Hospital in Phoenix of its affiliation with the Catholic diocese. The hospital's offense? It had terminated a pregnancy to save the life of the mother, who had severe pulmonary hypertension and would have died, leaving her four other children without a mom. Seeking to bully the hospital into submission, the bishop excommunicated a nun, Sister Margaret McBride, a hospital ethicist, who had approved this single exception to the no-abortion policy. But in an act of defiance that should chill the Vatican soul, the hospital ignored the bishop and still employs McBride. And the Catholic Health Association, a network of Catholic hospitals around the country, has chosen to stand behind St. Joseph's. This could be a critical turning point, as bishops obsessed with dogma, sanctity, rules, and the punishment of sinners harden their positions. Catholics are beginning to go their own way, openly. McBride has spent decades serving the neediest and sickest among us. There's little doubt about who is the Christ-like figure in this story. Now, as we continue reading The Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the section entitled The Last Word. And the specific title of the article this week is No Longer a Soldier. I'm home from Iraq in one piece, writes Matt Gallagher, but I'll never be the same. I'm one of the lucky ones. War destroys without regard to what's fair or just. This isn't a new or terribly profound revelation, but witnessing it and sometimes participating in it makes it seem like both. In a professional military, the entire point of training is to minimize the nature of chance in combat. But all the training in the world will never eliminate happenstance in war or even render it negligible. I returned from Iraq with all of my limbs, most of my mental faculties, and a book deal. I wake up every morning in an apartment in New York City. I'm working toward a graduate degree. I have a beautiful fiancé who reminds me to slow down when I'm drinking. And every day I feel more and more detached and removed from the Iraqi dustlands I promised myself I'd shed like snakeskin if I ever got back home. Like I said, one of the lucky ones. Meanwhile, the black bracelet on my wrist carries the names of four individuals who weren't so lucky. One got shot through the armpit with a ricocheting bullet and bled out on an outpost roof. Two drove over the wrong piece of street at the wrong time and likely didn't even know it was a roadside bomb that ended it all. The last one made it through 15 months of war only to get drunk one night back in the States and shoot himself in the face during an emotional breakdown. In Kurt Vonnegut's classic novel Slaughterhouse-Five, the protagonist, Billy Pilgrim, becomes unstuck in time, Much of the novel focuses on Pilgrim's experience of the firebombing of Dresden in World War II, something Vonnegut himself survived as an American prisoner of war. Like many American literature students, I was required to read Slaughterhouse-Five in high school, and if memory serves, I even enjoyed that assignment at 16. But I didn't really appreciate the concept of becoming unstuck in time until I returned from war. Just like anyone who poured blood, sweat, and tears into missions in faraway foreign lands, I left part of myself over there, and it remains there, while the rest of me goes about my business 6,000 miles away, a paradox of time and space Vonnegut captured all too brilliantly. I've walked by manholes in New York City streets and smelled the sludge river I walked along in the North Baghdad in 2008. I've stopped dead in my tracks to watch a street hawker in Midtown, a large black man with a rolling laugh and a British accent, who looked just like my old scout platoon's interpreter. And I've had every single slamming dumpster lid, every single damn one, rip off my fatalistic cloak and reveal me to be still a panicked young man desperate not to die because of an unseen IED. Despite these metaphysical dalliances with time travel, the names on my black bracelet are, in fact, stuck in time, or more accurately, stuck in memory, where they'll fade out and disappear like distant stars before becoming shadows of the men we served with and knew. So it goes. So it went for my friend Rob. During the invasion of Iraq in 2003, his unit drove through a neighborhood near Baghdad Airport in doorless Humvees. A civilian vehicle pulled out in front of them, temporarily blocking their path. A group of teenage boys stood aimlessly on the street, and one exchanged nods with Rob, who sat in the front passenger seat. Rob glanced away quickly to see if the civilian vehicle had moved yet, and then suddenly a grenade bounced off the inside of the windshield and into the vehicle. Rob followed the small plume of smoke and rattling noises, grabbing the grenade from behind the radio to his left. He picked it up, intending to throw it back out of the vehicle, but it slipped out of his hand and dropped, landing between his feet. He reached back down for it, fingers just meeting the casing when it exploded. He lost a hand and suffered severe nerve damage in his right leg as a result. Recounting the story over drinks one night, Rob said he wished he and the other soldiers in his Humvee hadn't taken their eyes off the Iraqi teens. Then he added that luck was for sure on our side that day, because had he not dropped the grenade but tossed it away as planned, it would have exploded at head level, likely killing him and possibly the Humvee's driver as well. He laughed deeply and clinked his prosthetic hook against my pint glass. Everything's relative, I guess, especially luck. If chance is war's dirty little not-so-secret self-righteousness is the veterans, upon returning to American society, it's all too easy to fall into pitfalls about what civilians get or don't get. 9 years of war fought by an all-volunteer force that constitute less than 1% of the total population has augmented this disconnect between soldier and citizen. In many ways, a separate warrior caste has evolved into being. The impact on our republic of fighting protracted landlocked wars with an all-volunteer force can be debated. The impact of it on those actually fighting can't be. After returning from Iraq and separating from active duty, I carried my self-righteousness around in the form of a portable soapbox for many months. Occasionally, this proved necessary. Sometimes the pejorative, they really didn't get it. There was the drunk Wall Street type who told me without a trace of irony but with plenty of faux jingoist twang, "It must be awesome to kill Hages." And there was the too-cool ultra-progressive who couldn't help but smirk condescendingly while pointing out that we signed on the dotted line after all, so we should have been ready for anything and everything before we departed for Iraq. Then, as passive-aggressively as possible, he analogized modern American soldiers to mercenaries. Though I'm certainly no tough guy, the primal urge to put both of these guys' faces through the nearest window was very real and very pointed. I didn't do that, though, for better or for worse. Instead, I told the former that some of my best friends were Muslim and that such a black-and-white understanding of the war is what got us into so much trouble over there in the first place. For the latter, I nodded and smiled, telling him that for someone who hadn't left the borough of Brooklyn in over a decade, he certainly possessed one hell of a world view. Neither talked to me again. So it goes. Most of the time, though, my soapbox and self-righteousness and sardonic wrath were unnecessary. Not because people didn't get it, but because I finally realized it wasn't their fault they didn't get it. They're not supposed to get it. This isn't Sparta, nor is it even post-World War II America. Sometimes, many times actually, they wanted to get it. Slowly and surely, I found the all-too-obvious solution of simply answering people's questions as considerately as I could, careful not to describe my experiences as universal to all of Iraq or all of Afghanistan. I'd rather ramble, I reasoned, and provide nuance and opinion than serve as the representational hollow caricature born only to sacrifice for fast food and online shopping and general postmodern excess. Just one man's solution to a litany of complexities, I guess. I got unstuck in time again last month, right when winter graced the eastern seaboard with its presence. I was getting out of the Union Square subway station, headphones on, mind turned out, stomach craving a cheeseburger. I don't qualify as a full-fledged New Yorker yet, but I've lived here long enough not to be disturbed by the sight of a cold and decrepit-looking homeless person. So, coming up the subway steps, I stroll by a young man with a scraggly yellow beard, wrapped in an urban camouflage jacket without anything more than a passing glance. He held a cardboard sign marked in black marker with the words, "Iraq Vet, Homeless, Please Help." I didn't help, nor did I give the man a second thought until two blocks later when I cynically scolded him in my head for using the veteran title to his advantage. But what if he really is an Iraq vet? I asked myself. I read the statistics. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, more than 100,000 veterans are homeless on a given night in America. The figure is twice that over the course of the month. Not all of the unlucky ones are dead, after all. So the old platoon leader in me kicked in, and I turned back around to see if I could verify any of this. Certainly, a legitimate vet would remember names, units, places, something, and then I'd help. Or I'd bring him to the people or organizations that could help him. Maybe if he seemed legit and came across as relatively stable, I could talk my fiancé into letting him sleep on the couch for a night or two, just to get him back on his feet, of course. He was no longer there, or anywhere nearby. Maybe someone else had helped him, but probably not. I initially breathed out a sigh of relief, and then a sigh of shame. I thought about how these wars may be coming to some sort of end, but veterans' issues for my generation are really just beginning. I only deployed for 15 months and had all kinds of support systems in place upon my return. What about the men and women who have done nothing but deploy and redeploy, rinse and repeat, since 9/11? What about those soldiers who returned to broken homes, mountains of debt, no professional goals beyond not going to war again? What about them? I smacked my lips and tasted guilt. Then I walked to a restaurant and ate a cheeseburger. Like the veterans who came before and the ones who will come after, I walked the streets of New York City, forever the soldier I no longer am. Oh, I'm no longer lean, hungry, or clean-cut. I've put on a little weight, grown my hair out, and sport a patchy beard that can best be described as pirate fashionable. But I still scan crowds for suicide vests, seek out corner vantage points like a bloodhound, and value competency in a human being above all else. Jumping back into civilian life headlong, like I originally had attempted to do, proved both disastrous and short-sighted. And coming to terms with this permanent state of combat readiness has made me realize just how much I miss war, or parts of it, and how lucky and twisted I am to be able to even write those words. I miss the camaraderie. I miss the raw excitement. I miss the Iraqi locals, from the kids who walked our daytime patrols with us to the frightened mothers who just wanted us to go away. I miss the soldiers, the NCOs, and even some of the officers. I miss that daily sense of purpose, survive or die, that simply can't be replicated in everyday existence. I miss standing for something more than myself, even if I never figured out just what the hell that something was supposed to be. I don't miss all of it, of course. I got out of the Army for some very good reasons. Love, sanity, bureaucracy, a holy trinity for our time. But there is a messy ambiguity at the core of this that must be conveyed, if not necessarily understood. I'm one of the lucky ones, unstuck in time. Stuck with chance, stuck at war. Considering the alternatives, I wouldn't want it any other way. That story originally appeared on the NewYorkTimes.com website in copyrighted 2011 by Matt Gallagher, and it was used, of course, by The Week magazine with his permission. You're listening to a reading of The Week magazine for February 11, 2011. Now let's take a look at a couple of items from Talking Points. Reagan at 100, the tug of war over his legacy. The political world as a whole has awakened to the greatness in Reagan, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. As we approach the 100th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's birth, Americans live in a nation and a world transformed by his deep belief in liberty, free enterprise, and American exceptionalism. Every potential GOP to 2012 presidential candidate claims to be a Reagan Republican, and in a real sense, they all are. 30 years ago, he wrenched the party away from the country club moderates who sneered at true conservatives. Among Reagan's unabashed admirers is a certain Ivy League lawyer from Hawaii, said Michael Shearer in Time. President Obama has studied Reagan's presidency as a model of transformational leadership and political evolution. Like Reagan, he has responded to a recession and a plunge in the polls with a strategic move to the middle. The fond tributes to the Gipper are justified, said Ryan L. Cole in the American Spectator, but I take offense at seeing the Reagan legacy appropriated by the wrong people, like the current Democratic president. Liberals are suddenly keen to have us forget that they once heaped histrionic levels of disgust on Reagan, denigrating him as an amiable dunce, fixated on free markets and anti-communism. We can't let Democrats now smooth out Reagan's prickly partisan edges in an effort to turn him into a warm and cuddly centrist. Sure, he made some compromises with the opposition. What president hasn't? But his triumphs were caused by his conservatism, not in spite of it. Maybe we liberals were too harsh about Reagan in the 1980s, said Walter Shapiro in PoliticsDaily.com, but it's 21st century conservatives who have airbrushed the man's record, his 8 budget deficits, his abject retreat from Lebanon following the 1983 bombing of a U.S. Marine barracks, his secret and illegal sale of arms to Iran's mullahs. Most of all, conservatives would prefer to forget that after slashing tax rates in 1981, Reagan raised them twice. Were he on the scene today, Reagan's tax realism alone would likely lead to his denunciation as a rhino, Republican in name only. Reagan was also far too sunny for today's Tea Party absolutists, said Nick Ragone in the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. Sadly, his cheerful optimism, his willingness to take half a loaf rather than none, would feel out of place in the vituperative politics of our age. The next item entitled Schools Where Jim Crow Lives On. This may be a Rosa Parks moment for education, said Kevin Huffman in the Washington Post. Kelly Williams-Bolar, a black single mom from the projects of Akron, Ohio, was convicted last week of a felony and sent to jail for 9 years. Her crime? Lying about her address so that her two daughters could attend a better, mainly white school in the suburbs. Her plight has caused an uproar because it shines a spotlight on America's dirty little secret. We may have done away with Jim Crow laws, but we have a Jim Crow public education system. The reality is that if you're middle class or wealthy, you can live in a community with good schools or send your kids to private school. If you're black and you're poor, you're out of luck. For daring to challenge that shameful inequity, Williams Bolar, a high school teaching assistant just one semester shy of completing her own college degree, was sent to jail. Message received, said Zengo Burton in the Root.com. Don't send your hood children to our white school district with better funding. Sad as this situation is, racism was not a factor, said Bob Dyer in the Akron Beacon Journal. The Copley-Fairlawn City School District has confronted 48 families of all colors in recent years who were lying about their addresses so their kids could attend the district's excellent public schools. When caught, all but Williams Bowler either took their kids out or paid tuition to the district to keep them in. As a homeowner in Copley-Fairlawn, I have paid high taxes for years to support the schools, which means Williams Bowler stole from my pocket. I sympathize with her goals for her kids, but not her methods. If your children's education is really your primary concern, move. What if you can't afford to move, said Deborah Simmons in the Washington Times. Rather than dooming inner-city kids to lousy public schools in their neighborhoods, the government should give their parents vouchers that would enable them to attend whatever school they choose. In Colorado, said Dan Haley in the Denver Post, parents have been allowed to cross district lines in search of a better public education for 17 years. The state has also aggressively embraced charter schools so as to provide competition and alternatives. What Williams Bolar did was wrong, but you shouldn't have to break the law to get your kid into a better school. Now an interesting item from the field of baseball. Gil Mesh saying no to $12.4 million. Finally, the search for a true role model in modern pro sports is over, said the Florida Times Union in an editorial. He's a relatively obscure pitcher named Gil Mesh, who was under contract to earn $12.4 million for the Kansas City Royals in the coming season. Mesh announced last week he would retire and forfeit the money. Why? Mesh's shoulder injuries have made him ineffective, leading the 32-year-old Louisianan to say, "I didn't feel like I deserved it." Under baseball's system of guaranteed contracts, said Tyler Kepner in the New York Times, Mesh would have gotten paid for the final year of his 5-year contract just by reporting to spring training. But taking a king's ransom from the Royals to sit on the bench just wasn't the right thing to do, says Mesh. Once I started to realize I wasn't earning my money, I felt bad. Stop the applause, said Kevin Baumer in BusinessInsider.com. A truly committed team player would have had surgery on his shoulder, undergone a grueling rehab, then worked his butt off to help the team as a relief pitcher. The truth is that Mesh's love of the game had clearly eroded in recent years. And with $43 million already pocketed over the previous 4 years, he clearly felt he had enough dough. If Mesh felt guilty, said Rob Nyer in ESPN.com, it's hardly surprising. He earned 3 times more than the next highest paid player on the small market Royals in return for a lackluster 29-39 record over 4 seasons. Mesh's $55 million contract was ridiculous the moment the Royals offered it, a reality that even Mesh could not stomach anymore. A couple of quick items here as we reach the end of our program. Egypt gets more U.S. foreign aid than any other country except Israel. The U.S. has been sending an average of $2 billion in cash and military arms to Egypt every year since 1979 when it agreed to a peace deal with Israel. And federal spending on hospice care tripled between 2000 and 2007 to more than $10 billion a year. Nursing homes and hospices are now among the top 10 employers in 20 different states. And finally, on the poll watch this week, 49% of Americans say speakers with southern accents sound like they're nice. 40% say the same about speakers with Midwestern accents, and 18% say New Englanders sound nice. Only 7% say speakers with New York accents sound nice, while 51% say New Yorkers sound rude. That from the Poll Watch at The Week magazine. Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and thank you so much for joining me today. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.